This is Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow night, the conversation of Powerhouse Seafood will be about everything, kind of. The latest edition of the Science Cafe, sponsored by the University of Arkansas's University of Arkansas STEM Center for Mathematics and Science Education, will consider origins from critters to cosmos. Three University of Arkansas professors will facilitate the conversation, which is open to the public. Peter Unger is Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Anthropology Department at the U of A. Steve Beaupre is Professor and Chair of the Biological Sciences Department. And Daniel Kenefick is Assistant Professor of Physics. Last week, the three professors came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF to discuss tomorrow night's Science Cafe, as well as the relationship between scientists, science, and the general public. We'll hear first from Steve Beaupre, Professor of Biological Sciences.
One of the things that strikes me about people that don't really fully understand evolution is that they sometimes think it's some kind of a very complex, difficult thing to understand. And we scientists have a tendency to make it complex and difficult because we're thinking about the theory in a very detailed way. But most people are surprised to find how simple the idea really is. The following from the concept that you have variability among organisms in nature, that variability is at least in some part heritable, and that there is differences in survival and reproduction based on that heritable variation. And if you put those three things together and can understand that those three elements are in place, then you believe in evolution. It's as simple as that.
Daniel? Steve has just explained that it's simpler than we think, biological evolution. The cosmos?
Well, I think the same thing does apply because while it is a vast subject that, as you mentioned, covers a huge terrain, at the same time, there are certain core questions which are easily articulated and whose answers are, when you really address the question in its, you know, without trying to do everything at once, can be not too hard to get across, really. So, if one talks about the classic question that it probably really only arose in its modern form 100 years ago is what's the shape of the universe? And, you know, it's pretty hard for us to imagine the universe in all of its four-dimensional glory and the concepts of space-time and all that, but we can talk about the difference between living in a flat world and living in a world that's curved around and shaped like a sphere or curved in another direction, which is somehow the opposite of that. Those things are difficult to really grasp fully conceptually, even for experts. But at the same time, it's not that hard to say the basics of it because there are only so many options available when you try to be simple about it.
Well, Peter, I've mentioned to you before in a conversation that this is the very thing that could keep me up at night, origins, start thinking about what happened. Do you get a lot of that from people who are not scientists, who might be students, who are not in the scientific fields?
Well, my own interest really is in human evolution. And as an anthropologist, the kinds of questions that I want to address are questions that relate to our place in nature. In a sense, we've heard here questions about, what is nature? What is the grander scheme of things in terms of the universe, in terms of life? But sort of what is our place in this puzzle? How did we get here? Why are we here? Which may be more of an epistemological question than a scientific one. But certainly we can address the hows to an extent. And I get that a lot. I mean, wanting to understand our place, where we fit in the grand scheme of things.
Do you get that, Stephen? The people wanting to know the hows and if not the whys?
I think a lot of times people confuse how and why. I think it's really fair to say that, as scientists, we think about how things work, like how does your muscle work when it contracts? And we can come up with a scheme that says, these are the steps that occur on a molecular level to produce that movement. A lot of times what we don't understand is why, for instance, a muscle is made up of different kinds of fibers and why, ecologically speaking, that composition is good for what the organism does. And those why questions take on a different cast. And a lot of times we ask why questions, and the answer is organic evolution, that natural selection produced this feature as an adaptation to a particular challenge in the environment. But other kinds of why questions that people have in an epistemological sense are, or why answers are, because a deity did it, or because the karmic universe produced this pattern over and over again. And yeah, I mean, when you're in a college classroom, there's every possible background in the room. And as a scientist, I spend a lot of time thinking about how I know what I know and how it differentiates from other ways of knowing that people have. And so we're constantly sort of walking that line and trying to get people to see things the scientific way, because that's our job.
The idea behind Science Cafe is not just here, but everywhere else, and I open this question to all of you, is to get beyond, you know, to get classroom professors and people who are not professors together to have a conversation about science. Do you think that happens enough? Do you think we, the average person, I know you can't speak for the average person, we have a workable knowledge of the subjects that we're talking about here, of evolution, of our place in nature?
See, I think that's a big, big problem. I think the answer is unequivocally no. Oftentimes, you go to a natural history museum and you see researchers giving talks. You can go to a university and you'll see researchers giving talks. Basically, they're preaching to the choir. The main problem that I see is Joe Sixpack is not getting the kind of general information and knowledge that they're going to get. And I think one of the main consequences of that has been tremendous underfunding on the federal level of scientific research, and it's getting much worse. I think if we could come up with a better approach to making science accessible to the general public, then they're going to be more excited about it, and that's going to translate through the legislature into more funding so that we can do more science and get even more people excited about it.
Easier said than done, though, right?
Let someone else answer that.
Yeah, it's difficult, and I think part of the issue that Peter's touching on actually reflects the fact that even among scientifically interested people, the things that they know and are interested, the questions that they're interested in asking about science can be, as is inevitably going to be the case, from really questions that were asked at a somewhat earlier period in scientific development. So that sometimes there's miscommunication between the scientists and the audience, because the audience are asking questions that might have made sense at one time before the scientist in question was ever born. So for instance, people talk a lot about evolution versus creationism being really a religious battle. And there's a lot of talk about the Bible. Well, you know, the Bible has precious little to say on the subject of evolution. In many ways, when you look at the battle, it seems to me like it's people who are still very interested in asking questions that were very meaningful in 19th century science, like, okay, what does it mean to talk about a species, and can you really go from one species to another, talking to, when they do talk, to professional scientists who are feeling like, well, that's a question that we feel was answered a long time ago. We want to respond to different questions than the ones you're asking. And that can be difficult because, of course, people may legitimately feel that they want the questions which they have in their heads to be answered, and those are not the types of questions that are relevant in today's science.
Carl Sagan wrote a book not too long before his demise called The Demon-Haunted World, which was a really interesting treatment of sort of how people think about in terms of religion and in terms of the sort of paranormal, in terms of, and it's all of its relation to science. And it's a really interesting treatment, but basically the idea that he, I think he got dead on, was that people have turned away in a lot of ways in the last 20 or 30 years from science. And we even see it, having ramifications in a political structure, because we fight with, we put the data out there, and then there's this political fight over the validity of the data, which is in a completely different realm than the scientific aspect of the data. So yeah, the scientists argue about data, and we argue about what they mean, and then sometimes we say, this is what we think it means, and we throw that out there, and it starts a political fight that goes beyond the data. And, you know, it's kind of scary, because some of the predictions of climate change, for example, are dire, yet we still argue about it until the evidence is incontrovertible. And the problem, I think, that arises with respect to that is that it's too late to do anything about it. By the time everybody goes, oh yeah, I get that now, I get it. And, You know, another great example was Paul and Ann Ehrlich, 1969, the book Population Bomb. And they revised that in 92 or 93, I think it's Population Explosion. And essentially, you know, these are dire warnings coming from a corner of the scientific community that are largely ignored. And, you know, some section of society registers it and worries about it, and everybody else just goes on with what they do.
And if I can add one more thing,
please.
I think that what we're the other issue is the dialogue between the scientist and the public is in a sense a dynamic. It's a back and forth, and we can benefit as well because most of us are so sort of deeply entrenched in our way of thinking about the world. The public can bring fresh perspectives. That's first of all. Second of all, many of us are so sort of tightly, what's the right word? Many of us spend so much time thinking in such a narrow way about what it is that we do. My PhD dissertation was 790 pages on a quarter of a square millimeter of one tooth. And I'm not kidding. When people ask the question, so what? It makes us think about things. We can't see the forest for the trees, but the public often can. And when I've spoken to people sitting next to me on an airplane, they often come up with ideas and thoughts that I would not have thought of because I'm not used to thinking that way, and it's benefited my work.
Sometimes you're talking about subjects that are far beyond, whether in the past or in distance. Is it a challenge to sometimes make that relatable to those of us who are not scientists or in the field?
It's tough. I use an analogy with my classes. I tell everybody to stretch their arms out as far as they can stretch them out, and I pretend to take a nail file and swipe the right index finger, just glance it or glaze it or just take a small filing off of that nail. And if the distance between your fingertips represents the age of the Earth, about 3.6 billion years, you've effectively wiped out all of human history. Hmm. It is very difficult to understand how short a period of time we've been on this planet in the grand scheme of things. I mean, there's been life on this planet for about, 3.8 billion years or so, which is probably, from Daniel's perspective, not all that long, but certainly from our perspective, a very long time. But we haven't been here as a species more than 250,000 years, probably. And as far as history goes, we're talking 10,000 years. So it is hard to put in perspective. But just as Steve was saying, I think this is all key to understanding our place in the natural world. And I think I agree with him. That's probably the most important thing we can pass on to our students.
Peter Unger is Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Anthropology Department at the University of Arkansas. We also heard from Daniel Kenefick, an Assistant Professor of Physics at the U of A, and Steve Beaupre, who's Professor and Chair of the Biological Sciences Department at the university. The three will facilitate tomorrow night's Science Cafe that takes place at Powerhouse Seafood in Fayetteville beginning at 6:30. The discussion is about origins, from critters to the cosmos. It's open to the general public.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. It's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide.
We're 30,000 light years from Galactic Central Point. And leave it to Monty Python to explain what it's all about. That from the movie The Meaning of Life. This is Ozarks at Large.